Well, we are getting overwhelming response to Andy Bashago, so much so, I'm going to keep him for the fourth hour. So we'll be back with your phone calls, and those of you who were on hold and hung up, try to get back on. But we'll take calls with you and Andy next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Andy, I have time traveled. I've gone into the future and yanked you back to the program. How are you?
Indeed. I had to teleport back to the phone, George.
Let me tell you something. The response is so overwhelming that I would not do justice to our listeners by only giving them an hour of phone calls with you. So we'll take advantage of this last hour. And Craig Hewlett was gracious enough, who just did a full show with me a week or so ago. We'll come back at a later date. But this entire project is incredible. Let's concentrate a little bit on Rumsfeld and Richardson. Rumsfeld, you know, in my book, has created problems in Iraq and Afghanistan with aspartame and everything else. Tell me what you think his true involvement was with Project Pegasus.
Well, I know what his involvement was. He was the defense attaché. My father and I had substantial contact with Don Rumsfeld when we were on the project. He was well-regarded, and in fact, he was at a phase in his career where he hadn't made all these controversial decisions. And so I think, to the extent that he's now a man in his mid-70s of advanced years, he has everything to gain historically by coming clean about this particular chapter in his career so that teleportation can literally be unleashed to advantage humanity. I mean, he's had a very controversial career. But in those days, he was a 39-year-old former congressman who basically had been appointed to a board that President Nixon had established, and yet was secretly serving on this time space project. And so I think that Secretary Rumsfeld will want to come forward to be responsible for this particular chapter in the history of our country, in which we acknowledge the fact that we developed this technology.
How will you try to get a hold of him or Bill Richardson to at least come clean?
I'm going to write them letters explaining why I think that the highest form of public service would be represented by embodied in coming forward now, and simply acknowledging that we developed teleportation. We kept it secret because, as Don Rumsfeld said in the talk that I was in that he gave a meet and greet in April of 71 at an underground amphitheater, sort of an intelligence committee briefing room, again in Cerrillos, New Mexico. And he described how the significance of the technology was to allow the military to put troops precisely where they were needed on the battlefield. Well, he's now lived another 30, 35, 40 years in that realm of focusing strictly on defense matters. And I think yet he possesses the intelligence to recognize the fact that teleportation could be so much more. It could be the way that we literally get from, you know, Grand Central Teleport in New York City to Union Teleport in Los Angeles in a couple seconds. So I think that he has everything to gain historically and personally by simply affirming the fact that we did develop this technology and it has great potential, and that potential was not implemented because the technology has remained weaponized since Tesla's death.
When was the last time that you teleported? How old were you?
Oh, God.
It's been years?
I was. Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. In the summer of 1980, I had to teleport between a teleport near the Van Nuys Air Force Base in California, airfield, I should say, the Van Nuys Airport, and an area behind one of the labs in Los Alamos, because they found during my junior high school and high school years that I was quantum slipping. I was having experiences, let's say, where I was putting my books in my backpack in junior high school, and I could hear all the kids roughhousing behind me, you know, all the other junior high kids. And then suddenly I hear a ringing in my ears as the sound diminished, and I found myself standing there by my locker alone. So at some point between the time that I was marshaled out of Project Pegasus as an 11-year-old in 1972, and then we moved to Southern California, and my first year of college, the intelligence community, which obviously my father had remained in communication with, if not working for, determined that a quantum slipping was going on that needed to be corrected. And so they had me teleport from Van Nuys to Los Alamos and back to try to correct that. That had resulted from an episode at Sandia in 1971 when my father was supposed to get me through the teleport back to New Jersey by 9 p.m., but he became engrossed in a discussion with another engineer. He met in the hallway there, And I finally ended up jumping through the teleport at Sandia at 9:02 p.m. And I don't know what the basis in physics is for what happened, but I somehow, the witching hour was actually 9 p.m. I was supposed to have jumped through the device 2 minutes earlier. And that created some kind of technical problem that they were trying to correct. So that was the last time that I teleported, was in 1980. Oh, well, on Earth. But then in 1981, in the summer of 1981, they had placed the CIA agent in my life named Courtney M. Hunt. And the question that he was plying with me the entire summer of 1981, you know, June, early July of 81, is, do you want to go to Mars? And I said, quite frankly, no, I don't. And so I finally relented when he explained, well, you have to go to Mars because the survival of human life relies on it or depends on it. Yeah. And I think by that he meant that there we have to have possess the courage to go off planet. So in any case, I did two jumps to Mars via a jump room at a CIA facility in El Segundo, California in 1981. And I think that was as a result of both the intelligence community wanting to acclimate me to Mars because they knew what my destiny was relative to the discovery of life there, you know, the natural history work that I'm about right now, articulating what's up there, but also simply because I'd been one of the kids who had served on Project Pegasus. So I haven't, since 1980, I haven't done any of these teleportings around the country like I did as a child, but there were several one-off jumps to Mars in 1981, and I don't think we have time to get into that tonight, but that's part of why I'm speaking out now, which is to reveal the fact that we've been using teleportation to reach Mars, and I don't think we should move forward as a civilization keeping such activities secret from the majority of human beings on our planet.
Interesting. Paul Guercio, who heads up the Merlin Project, which is a computer software program that predicts and analyzes timelines for the future, says that one of his clients is former Secretary of Defense William Cohen under the Bill Clinton administration, wants to know if you want an entree there. If you do, let me know. And he said he'll work on it. So that would be Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, William Cohen. Can he help you at all?
Well, if he can, I would certainly like to talk to him. I think that's a very generous offer. But yes, I want to work through positive people in the political life of our country simply to achieve the revelation of the teleportation capability. This is as significant, it was when Tesla developed it, as significant as the achievement of air flight by the Wright brothers, as significant as the landing on the moon. And yet we kept it secret because a determination was made during World War II that this should be used as a weapon system. And it could be so much more than that. So if Secretary Cohen and other positive, progressive people in our political culture want to assist me in this effort, I would consider it a privilege to work with them to bring this to the attention of the American people.
All right, back to the phones we go. We'll pick it up by going to Jackie in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Jackie, good morning.
Good morning. I would like to know if you see anything positive about the United States economy since China is becoming a little bit restless and they want to execute their lien on our U.S. Treasury.
Well, again, I've resolved not to become a prognosticator or soothsayer because the factual basis story is my 10-year investigation carried out roughly between age 38 and now 48 to go back and describe what happened 40 years ago. And so I'm not really in a position to make a set of predictions about coming events. I am an optimist, however, because I've been to the future and it's a beautiful place to visit. And so I think in the long haul, the world that our children and grandchildren will be living in will be a very nice place to inhabit. And so ultimately I'm an optimist. But I don't have the factual basis, in fact, to make near-term predictions like that, because what I overheard at the dinner table 40 years ago was very limited. In fact, they were keeping from the children in the program most of the knowledge about future events, for example, that were being summarized in the kinds of intelligence reports that Don Rumsfeld and my father and other principals on the project were promulgating.
Though it's probably a different show, give me a highlight on what you think is on Mars.
Well, my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, is an analysis of a single NASA image, image PIA-10214, which was taken from the western edge. It's a westward view from the western edge of the home plate plateau in the Columbia Hills range of the Gusev crater of Mars. And what that shows is, as I described it in my paper, literally it's a cosmic treasure trove of humanoid beings, different animal species, very ornate carved statues, and some built structures that we found in that photograph and other photographs taken by both NASA and the European Space Agency. So we're really entering a new era here of Mars anomaly research, where the great foundation made by people like Richard Hoagland, Mike Barra, Graham Hancock, Robert Bovall, Carl Munk, and others, is now being supplemented with data from the rovers, in which we're seeing that, in fact, Mars was not just inhabited in ancient times, as the satellite imagery has always suggested, but the rovers show, in fact, is an inhabited planet today. And that's fraught with implications and complications that we simply haven't even discussed as a global society here on Earth, much less resolved.
Okay, next up we go to Gerald in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Gerald, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey,
Gerald.
Good talking to you guys. Hey, I had a dream the other night that there was a economic collapse, total collapse inside the U.S., and there was two different factions fighting. There was two different military groups, like generals, fighting it out inside the U.S. Is there any indication of this type of activity that you've seen?
No, there was no data that was derived from Project Pegasus that I either learned directly or heard about that indicated any future civil war scenario in the United States.
All righty, thanks.
All right, appreciate you being part of that program. Next up, we go to Temecula, California, first-time caller. Hello there, go ahead.
Hi, George, this is my night. I got disconnected twice, and I was able to call in a third time.
Not this time. Go ahead, you're all set.
Okay, so George, I'd like to thank you for being a link in the chain, first off, and I was on the chat last night. And I have a question for you, Andrew, and thank you for being on air today, tonight.
Thank you.
Are the teleportation hubs that you're talking about, are they located in a specific pattern around the Earth, like perhaps Buckminster Fuller's shape of the dodecahedron or something of that nature?
That question comes up quite a bit because of the information that we have about ley lines, that there's a natural geomagnetic grid around the surface of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that the teleports were located on either ley lines or intersections of ley lines, primarily because when Jack Pruitt trained us on the teleport at Curtis Wright, he explained that what Tesla had discovered was a way using hardware, basically using a device, to draw a form of energy that permeates the universe, that he was calling radiant energy, that it had among its properties the capacity to bend the fabric of time-space. So I don't believe that the connection with ley lines was required, because the device was able to propagate one of these portal tunnels wherever it was placed.
These portal tunnels, could they be rainbow tubes of light at any time?
Well, they were tubes of light. That's a pretty accurate description. But they were moving tubes of light. So as you were moving through the portal tunnel, the walls of the portal tunnel seemed to be moving behind you. And if you look to the side, you saw that all sorts of transparent images of different random events were occurring.
Oh, interesting. I had an experience in Machu Picchu where I was all of a sudden popped into space and I saw these planetary spheres. And first I was attracted to it by a screeching sound, and I turned to my right, and all of a sudden, boom, I was in the solar system watching this sphere go by me. But the sound connected me from this world to the black, deep space. And then I had another experience that same day. Later on, I was going through a rainbow tube of light, and I go, wow, I wonder if I could slow this down. But before I even thought that, each color was in my peripheral vision, slowing down one at a time. So it's interesting that, I went back into Cusco at the time, and it said, this is the Rainbow Tube of Light. I mean, Rainbow City of Light, they called it, on a poster.
Right. Well, there wasn't a rainbow pattern inside the tunnel. It was more of a blue-white luminous quality. I think it was distinguished by the fact that when you looked at the walls of the tunnel, you could see all of these holographic images of random events from different timelines rushing past you. The universe was actually being opened and moved past us. That's how it was explained to me. But I'm not a physicist, so I can't actually explain how it was being accomplished. But I will state the truth to the end of my days, which is that we were doing it.
Andy, whatever happened to the other youngsters who were part of the Pegasus program? Where are they now?
Well, I spoke to six or seven of them who were in my immediate group. The 140 American school kids who were brought into Project Pegasus were arrayed in 14 groups of 10 co-experiencers. And each of them had a team captain who received specialized training if a mishap occurred on the project. I had been selected as the captain of Blue Team. So, for example, when we jumped from through the device in 1971 and found that we had accidentally arrived in 1991 in Santa Fe, and I had to summon help from Sandia, I kind of pulled rank and asserted my authority as captain of Blue Team, and we got home through by somebody coming up from Sandia, and we jumped basically 20 years home. I was able to question those six or seven participants from my team at length, and what I found was very interesting. Everything that involved quantum access that had occurred inside the four corners of the learning lab that we were placed in, being placed in the Montauk chair, participating in remote viewing for the U.S. Navy, being spun to induce out-of-body experiences, and the kind of far-out things that were going just within the learning lab, all of the participants remembered that. But then when I began questioning them about things that had happened at the defense labs in New Jersey, like the probe to 2013 that we took part in up at ITT Defense, their memories were far more partial and fragmentary. And it was clear to me that they had been basically brainwashed to forget what happened. And in the book, I'm going to describe what some of these things that were done to us were done to basically prevent us or try to create a situation in which we wouldn't want to revisit our memories. There were some very brutal things that were done to us. And, you know, I think the part of the human story of my account is the fact that I overcame that mistreatment, and I resolved spiritually that I would not forget what happened, so that when I grew up, I could help liberate teleportation so that it could advantage everybody on our planet. But that's really another dimension of the story, is that one solitary individual overcame that brainwashing, overcame just the trauma of being in the project per se, and I'm now able as an adult to integrate what happened and share it with others so that maybe we can do something with this teleportation technology. But I was able to reach six or seven of them, and their memories were essentially corroborative of mine, except, for example, when I'd have a discussion about what happened at a different defense contractor location off campus, let's say they would talk about it one Saturday morning, and then the next Saturday they would not only forget what they had said, but forget that we had talked the previous Saturday. So I'm sorry to say that my co-participants, I think, are still victims of the brainwashing that was inflicted on us.
Do you believe the government has stopped the program, or might it be continuing in some form or fashion?
Well, we know that it was operational in 81 because that was the time and it had actually been modeled into jump rooms, where you were literally encased in something when you were located somewhere else in the universe, because that was the basis by which I did the two trips up to Mars. We also know it was still operational in 1991, fully 20 years after I was a child participant, because of the mishap that occurred in 71 when we were confused when we got to the state capitol grounds there in Santa Fe, because the landscape had changed. And we asked some kids coming out of the roundhouse what year it was, and they told us it was 1991. So we know that it was still operational in 91 because we got home to 1971 mm-hmm. from a teleport at Sandia. We also know that it was still operational in different parts of the country in 2000, because that's when they The jump between Van Nuys and Los Alamos was in 1980. So the farthest I can take the timeline is to 91, when we got back from Sandia back
1991. Okay, we'll be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Sci-Fi's 2012 show did very well in the ratings. That's the program that highlighted Richard C. Hoagland. And as a matter of fact, on our next Coast to Coast program, Whitley Strieber, Bob Gleason join us as we talk about 2012 and the implications for all of us from their perspective. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Andy on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Andy Bashago. Am I pronouncing your name right all night, by the way? Bashago, is it?
That's correct. It's Bashago, like Chicago.
I almost, when I was reading it the first time a couple of weeks ago, I almost said Bashago. It looks that way.
Yes.
But it's not.
It's a Polish name.
It looks Italian.
Right. There's a district in Ravenna that's called Bashago, but it's actually, my dad was a Polish-American. It actually means, I believe, beekeeper in Polish, as derived from the medieval Latin word for bees.
Because as we know, there are no more bees anymore. I wonder, did you guys look at the bees in the future, find out what happened to the honeybees?
No, but strangely, I found a very elaborate statue of a bee with the head of a man that's located immediately west of the Home Plate Plateau. That's one of the more interesting statues that I found up on Mars. So it's odd that we would find the statue of a bee with the head of a man at this time in Earth's history on one of our neighboring planets.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Final calls here. The wild card line, Eugene, Oregon, we go. Mike, go. Hi, Mike.
Yeah. Hi, George. Hi, Andrew. It sounds like you are coming across with a positive agenda. It doesn't sound to me like you have ulterior motives. And the way I look at the world, if people were allowed to be culture-free, ethical, independent, as opposed to the state of things now, the way we're degraded, poisoned, dumbed down, the world could be sustaining, even with what the population is currently, 6.5 billion people. I think about this a lot. I've thought about it a lot. And I don't think it's just a few or a few hundred megalomaniacal people destroying humanity and the planet. I think it's ancient, intergalactic, and it's also existing on and within this planet. Who or what is at the top or bottom of this unnecessary tragedy?
I don't know. That's a very broad question. You're almost asking me to resolve what the source of evil is in the world. I'd like to look at that equation in terms of asking ourselves what we can do to make a difference. I think we can all make a positive difference in the world, and all we have to do is try. You know, when I first began my investigation and writing project regarding my childhood experiences in Project Pegasus, naturally and understandably, I was disbelieved by my old friends in Los Angeles, my siblings, because in fact, in the case of my four brothers and sisters, my project experiences had been secreted from them by my father because they didn't have a need to know what we were involved in. But now I'm looking at a situation in which people are contacting me from all over the world to encourage me in my truth campaign. So I think just in my own experience over the last decade, I've been able to experience the fact that if you dedicate yourself to a positive goal and don't give up and don't give in, you can have a positive impact, and you'll start to find other human beings actually embracing what you're trying to accomplish, and you'll be lifted forward by the buoyancy of their spiritual commitment to what you're trying to achieve. That's already happened in my life, and I'm, quite frankly, profoundly moved by it. So I think rather than asking the big picture questions of what the source of evil is in the world or whether we've been undermined by broad cosmological patterns, we should try to work on the more intermediate level of what can we do to leave the world a better place during this brief moment in time when we're alive.
Was there anything in your travels, teleportation travels, Andy, that scared the living daylights out of you?
Oh, God. Not really. There was one of the paradoxes that was occurring that definitely left a profound sadness and impression on me. Because we did do a chronovisor probe. The first chronovisor probe in Morristown, we went to the time of the dinosaurs, and I saw some immense dinosaurs, but I wasn't frightened by them. They were long-necked dinosaurs that were chomping on grass. One of the things that really horrified me and left a sense of profound sadness is they sent me to New York City around 1900 to the Five Points neighborhood of New York City that's depicted in that famous movie, Gangs of New York. And I found myself trapped in a squalid tenement for 3 days. The paradox that was occurring is when we would be placed in the holograms, the program administrators believed that we were only in for several minutes. And I was finding that once we were immersed in the hologram, we were frequently in there for days. And so one of the more terrifying aspects as a child was just fending for myself for several days while we were in these virtual realities that we had been immersed in. And in that case, I was in a tenement that was so squalid I could hardly even stand the smell of it. It was just a miserable place to be. And so I think I have a special insight now at this point to really how miserable living conditions were in certain periods of history and how lucky we are to enjoy a much better time to be alive.
We are very lucky, aren't we?
Yes. We're very lucky.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to Brian in Oregon City, Oregon. Go ahead, Brian. You're up with us.
Hey, George. I have to be frank. I really don't believe your guess. I want to know why, if we have all this wonderful time travel technology that's so fantastic, why 9/11 wasn't, like, undone?
Well, that's a good question, and I respect the fact that you don't believe me, and all I can do is simply speak my truth and sort of let the chips fall where they may. I am telling the truth. 9/11 hasn't come up yet in tonight's broadcast, and so let me raise it. Project Pegasus recovered prior information about 9/11. I witnessed it personally. What it had was an 18 to 20 second film loop of one of the planes hitting one of the Twin Towers. I saw that that we were called down to the Aerojet Corporation facility that formerly existed at the corner of Bullock Avenue and Leroy Place in Socorro, New Mexico. Now, the reason I believe that 9/11 wasn't stopped as a result of the Defense Department having prior knowledge of it is it may have been a practical reason, but that was just an intelligence finding that got dropped into files, and then people like Don Rumsfeld and others who were then in government when 9/11 occurred simply weren't even thinking about what had previously been detected by Project Pegasus about that horrific event. But in general terms, one of the reasons they decided to not change future events was because if it's a big event like 9/11 that affects a lot of people, if you prevent it from happening, you then divert the course of all of the events that occur after that event. And if you're involved in an intelligence gathering project, the purpose of which is to discern information from the past and future that you can act upon, the paradox is you can't change a future event and not diminish the quality of the intelligence database that you're gathering for events after that big event. So I believe that relative to 9/11, that the U.S. government knew that it was coming. We have evidence of that made in statements by the president, by Condoleezza Rice, and others. We have the president's statement that he saw the first plane hit the first tower. We have Condoleezza Rice's advisement to former Mayor Brown of San Francisco not to fly that day. We have the moving of Don Rumsfeld's desk to the other side of the Pentagon and other clues that they were preparing for that event on that day. I believe the reason that they let it happen is not because they're evil people, but simply because it's in the nature of quantum access that if you stop or prevent a major event in the future, you essentially diminish the intelligence value of the intelligence database you've gathered for all events occurring after that mega event. And that's what I believe happened on 9/11.
Okay, thank you. Calvin, Cincinnati, Ohio, first-time caller. Hi, Calvin, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Andy, how are you today?
Good, good.
I've been listening to you all night. A lot of the stuff that you've been talking about, very interesting. One of the questions I had was, what's the name of your book that's coming out, and when will it be out?
The title is Once Upon a Time in Time's Stream, My Adventures in Project Pegasus at the Dawn of the Time-Space Age, and it should be out by the late spring. I have 225 passages written, and I simply have to find some quiet hours away from my professional activities as a trial lawyer to sit down and knock out the final manuscript.
Well, very good. Let's go next to Springfield, Missouri. David, east of the Rockies. Hey, David, go ahead.
Yes, sir. George, Andrew, it's a true pleasure. And I would just like to say, Andrew, my question is, I got to say, I'm a bit of a skeptic. What you're saying really intrigues me, but I've got to ask, is there something that you can tell the Coast to Coast listeners to reaffirm, you know, let's say, can you tell us who the next president is going to be? Can you tell us something that's going to happen in the near future, in which case where the listeners will say just wow and be astounded, you know, blow your mind, wow, you know, that he's true?
Right. Well, let me answer that specific question. It came up earlier, and I just want to emphasize that there were really only a couple things about the future that I was able to glean simply by having the opportunity to sit around the dinner table, the lunch table, in a social context when I was a child participant on the project.
And again, how old were you again, Andy, when this was happening?
Well, I first teleported to Santa Fe with my father in the 1967-68 time frame, and we know that because when we met with Dr. Agnew at the Los Alamos Labs, he asked my dad how old I was, and we both said simultaneously 6. But then after a couple more experiences where he took me to project locations, I wasn't officially enrolled in the project until the fall of 1969 when I was 7 going on 8. And then I was in the project for 3 years till age 11. And then my project experiences ended as an official matter, and then we moved to Southern California when I was 11. But let me just say that there were only a couple of events in the future that I was able to identify retrospectively from 40 years out, you know, as an adult, that I know to an historical certainty that the project had knowledge about. And those were, I mentioned the particular presidencies. There was also a discussion of the advent of AIDS, in other words, a sexually transmitted disease that could be lethal. There was a discussion about the internet, I know, that took place at the dinner table, and somebody was trying to explain to my dad what it was. And then he got up from the table and it said, well, this .com thing still bothers me. I mean, how do we know that doesn't mean that the commies have taken over by then? So they clearly had a knowledge of the advent of the internet. And just a few events like that, 9/11 I mentioned, but it wasn't as if I was being briefed all the time on what the future held. So the only reason I'm able to historically look back and say, well, these are the presidents they knew about, is because their names came up. And I don't have any discrete memory of somebody after President Obama being president. But I would say that prior to President Obama's election, I did share with some of my research associates, including Alfred Weber, the fact that President Obama would be our next president, because when I met him when we were college students, one of his close associates said that I should be nice to him because he was going to be president of the United States someday. So, and I've correlated that to this whole issue of quantum access. Generally, let me say this, and that is that to skeptics, I would say this. Look, between what the American public has been told the U.S. government has achieved and between what it has really achieved falls everything that falls under the umbrella of official state secrecy. So when somebody like myself comes forward and shares what occurs in that part of the graph between the known and what is unknowable because it remains secret, are all the secrets. And so all I can do is just tell the truth. Hopefully people will see that I am telling the truth, but I can't convince those who would choose not to believe my veracity or the factuality of what I'm articulating. I'm just trying to share what happened so that people can derive an understanding of the fact that 40 years ago in America's defense labs, the time-space age emerged and very few people were told about it.
Very few. Couple minutes to go. Rebecca in Huffman, Texas. Hey, Rebecca, go ahead.
Great show, as always. I was wondering if the television show Fringe has any basis to Andy's research.
Well, I've heard some reports about elements of Fringe mirroring some of my allegations or some of the facts of my case. And that could just be because these ideas are in the ether right now, like a lot of scientific and parascientific premises. I also did present my story to a number of top television networks back in 2007, and I hope that information from my own account hasn't formed the basis of Fringe or other science fiction shows. So I think that's a question that I wouldn't hazard to try to answer at this time. I have heard that Fringe has described certain things that are very similar to my experiences, and all I can say is I've already presented my account to several leading television networks, and I hope that my facts haven't formed the basis of several of today's.
Maybe the government is putting shows out like Fringe to condition us for the release of this information.
Well, they knew, even going back 40 years ago, that I was going to be launching this truth campaign. In fact, I was persona non grata in the project roughly from the summer of 1971 until I was terminated from the project after the summer of 72. Of course, we had pre-experienced the summer of 73 by accessing it from November of 71. But they've known for 40 years that my personal destiny would involve bringing this information to the attention of the American people. And so it's quite possible that if mass media is being used in that way, that these ideas are now being dropped into science fiction dramas on television to confuse the public about the historicity of my claims.
Right. Even basic cartoons now have got, you know, Earth people going to, like, alien planets, and we're scaring the aliens. So, you know, they're even conditioning the toddlers of this world right now, is what I'm seeing.
Well, apropos of that, all I can say is I'm independent. I'm not involved in any kind of release of this information on behalf of any U.S. government agency. I've been very transparent about the different branches of the intelligence community that I've been attached to in the past as a result of my project experiences. This is an independent whistleblower campaign, and it's an authentic expression of my life experience and the political act that I've undertaken, and I'm not involved in any kind of release of this information on behalf of the government, although I do believe that the government should take responsibility for releasing this information.
Have you ever been accused of being a disinformation specialist or anything like that?
Every day, George. I mean, it's so ironic because, you know, I find myself being able to have the privilege of first being in this project, and then also hopefully my truth campaign will succeed and we'll be able to use teleportation to literally revolutionize transportation on our planet, particularly if President Obama does the right thing and declassifies it during his administration so we can launch that project as soon as possible. But yes, every day I receive emails on either my Mars findings or my Pegasus revelations stating that I'm a disinformation agent. And I really respond that, hey, I'm flattered because my information must be so seamless that you don't trust it. But I am not a disinformation agent. In fact, in my book, I'm going to provide copious factual analysis that I think will convince the fair-minded reader that I'm telling the truth.
Okay, very good indeed. Well, all I know is that you bring together a very fascinating, fascinating story, Andy, and stay in touch with us in the future, okay?
I will. It's been a privilege to be on your show. You know, I've been a listener, I think, since the very earliest days with Art, and I never thought I would be on. It certainly wasn't something that I visited from the past back when I was time traveling on Project Pegasus, and it's just been an honor and a privilege to be with you during tonight's show, and hopefully we'll have the impact and be able to get this teleportation capability, wrestle it out of the grips of the defense technical community and use it to advantage everybody on our planet.
Well, you definitely keep in touch with us, Andy. I appreciate you being on the show. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.